Thank you. So my name is Sergei Kruzhinsky. I'm a postdoc at Michael Desai's lab at Harvard. And well, first of all, thanks to the organizers for putting together this so far really fantastic program and giving me opportunity to talk. So I want to talk today a little bit about this question: how does demography affect adaptation? And I should tell you up front that I'm certainly not going to answer this question in this talk. So maybe we'll be able to identify some more specific questions which can be addressed theoretically in this respect, and also experimentally. And I want to present some recent experimental work that I've done with Michael. And maybe there are some interesting things that come out of it. So when we think about adaptation, when I think about adaptation, I always, or evolution in general, I think about it as sort of in the simplest possible scenario as a three-layer problem. So we have, of course, somewhere at the bottom, the fundamental level of evolution is the cell, right? And of course, there are, when we think about life, there are actual organisms involved in it, and so there is an environment. There are environments. The organisms perceive the environment. There are molecules diffusing through the membranes, triggering some pathways, and then some genes get expressed, some genes get repressed, and so on. And of course, so there are some regulatory networks involved, and some proteins have to fold properly. And of course, mutations come in and they perturb these networks and the proteins. And then this changes somehow the response of the cells or of the organisms to the environment. And so this is sort of the bottom layer. From the point of view of evolution, all of this, of course, is important, but it can sometimes, or maybe even often, can be summarized in something that is, this layer is very complicated. So we can sometimes summarize it in terms of something slightly less complicated, which we call the fitness landscape, which is basically the distribution of fitness effects of mutations. So we kind of forget about all this machinery that goes on here, which perturbs these complicated networks and proteins. And we simply think sometimes about the distribution of fitness effects of these mutations. So basically, we measure this one quantity, which is called fitness, and try to sort of figure out how adaptation proceeds depending on just the fitness landscape and not on this whole complicated machinery here. And of course, there are lots of complications involved from going from this layer to this layer, because, well, so we substituted this very complicated, these complicated networks with just a simple quantity called fitness. And so how do we measure fitness, for example, is one problem. And if we think about these distribution of fitness effects, if we have defined fitness, if we think about the distribution of fitness effects, we have to sort of keep in mind that this distribution is not just one distribution. It is variable between environments. It can change depending on which mutations the organism has already substituted. So we have to think about epistasis. I think that's really one of the sort of most important notions in adaptation or in evolution in general. So when we have defined this fitness landscape or somehow measured the fitness landscape, we can try to understand what happens at this third layer at the population level, because of course all organisms live in some populations and wouldn't have any evolution or any adaptation anyway that if we didn't have populations and if mutations didn't spread in populations, right? So we need to understand that even if we knew perfectly what the fitness landscape looks like, we still need to understand how these mutations appear in the populations and how they spread. And that depends, of course, on various parameters. There's demographic parameters. For example, it depends on population structure, depends on population size, and various other things. So And sometimes I think many theoreticians, especially I'm certainly thinking about myself, when we think about this layer, we frequently forget about these two layers. And I sort of, only when I start doing experiments, start thinking more about these two layers. And I think it's very important. Especially it's important, I think, when this layer, when the population level feeds back onto this organismal level. And that certainly happens very frequently, as Jeff Gore, for example, has showed yesterday. So we have frequency-dependent selection. So the environment itself is shaped by the organisms. So we have to think about these three layers. So today I will talk only about, despite all this caution that I just mentioned, I will talk about just this layer, about the demography, how the demography affects adaptation. So very frequently, and I think it's mostly for historical reasons, people have focused on just one demographic parameter and how this one demographic parameter affects adaptation. That's population size. So there has been an incredible amount of work on understanding how adaptation depends on the population size. And I'll just because it's such an important body of work, I'll give a very quick summary of that. But that's not what we have done in Michael's lab. So we have looked at a different demographic parameter, which is population structure in the sort of simplest possible case. Okay, first, let me just tell you, most people, I suppose, know all of this, but let me just go through this very quickly, how population size depends, how population size influences adaptation. So in the absolutely simplest case, when we have well-mixed asexual populations with the single parameter population size, and they can, if this n is sufficiently small, then beneficial mutations are very rare. I think we actually understand adaptation reasonably well. So we can write down fixation probabilities of these mutations depending on their selective advantages, and we can even incorporate the sort of the underlying fitness landscape into this whole picture. We can basically predict how the fitness of a population would evolve on various types of fitness landscapes. So the important thing here is that when the population size is small, the rate of adaptation depends on the population size linearly. So fitness increases as the population size goes up. Fitness at the rate of adaptation increases linearly with the population size.
That's a mean over the entire population?
Yeah, yes. So of course this is not true anymore when the population size gets sufficiently large that beneficial mutations start competing with each other. So I show this phenomenon which is called clonal interference, when several beneficial mutations appear in the population in the wild type background. For example, here I show mutations which is called AB. This is from Phil Gerrish and Rich Lansky's paper, and mutations A capital B. So these two types are beneficial. They carry a beneficial mutation, and the second type, which carries the allele, the capital allele B, the second locus, has a larger selective advantage, but it appears later in the population. And so this first mutation, which has a smaller beneficial mutation, with a smaller effect, it appears earlier, but then it gets outcompeted by the second mutant, which has a larger beneficial mutation but appears later. So you see that basically this first mutation was wasted essentially, because it never got substituted in the population. And so when you have multiple mutations coming up in a sexual population, they compete with each other and they inhibit each other's fixation. So the rate of adaptation is no longer linear, it curves down, and there is actually a hard speed limit on the rate of adaptation in this in this clone interference regime. What is the population size? So as the population size gets larger and larger, the rate of adaptation doesn't increase anymore. So it's not no longer linear in the population size. So there's another complication which is kind of parallel to this one, which is called the piggybacking or multiple mutation regime. So if the beneficial mutations are common, but they appear not in the wild type background, but appear sort of on top of previously existing beneficial mutations, then there are many types which carry various numbers of beneficial mutations in the population. So you have this distribution of fitnesses within a population. And of course, because most of beneficial mutations happen in the bulk of the population, they will never get any chance of fixation because there is a small fraction of the population here which carries a large number of beneficial mutations already, and it's sort of destined to substitute to substitute in the whole population. So the mutations that happen here basically don't contribute anything to adaptation, and only mutations that happen here at the nose of this wave are important. So again, in this regime, the rate of adaptation is not linear in the population size, it's logarithmic in the population size. And so I want you to, so although I'm not talking exclusively about populations, I want you to keep this, this picture, I guess, in mind, and this logarithmic dependence on population size in mind, because I'll come back to this when I show you the experimental data.
Right. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. You said there was a hard speed limit.
There was a hard speed limit, yes. So so these two regimes, the clone interference and this piggybacking, they're not mutually exclusive. So they sort of happen at the same time. So mutations obviously can arise either in the wild type background or in the clone that has already one or more beneficial mutations. And so these two models, they capture these two separate things. So clone interference captures this regime when the beneficial mutations arise only in separate in the wild type background, and they compete with each other. This other model captures this effect when the beneficial mutations are right on top of each other. But in reality, of course, these two things happen simultaneously, and it's not clear which one is more important, and they're both important, but they give different predictions. That's true. So this one doesn't have a hard speed limit, and the other one does. So we have to. This part of the theory, I think, is not developed to understand how these two things interact.
In your distribution, what is the meaning of log of 1/5 S?
Where is that?
On the x-axis.
This one.
Bottom. No, on the y-axis.
On the y-axis? Oh, this. So this is the threshold. So this is kind of a little bit technical. This is from the paper by Michael Desai and Daniel Fisher. So they are trying to calculate the speed of adaptation in this regime, and this quantity is the frequency of a type. Let's say, for example, this type. So if any type in the population exceeds this frequency, then it basically starts growing deterministically.
That's 5 is just an approximation to a threshold.
So 5S, I think, in this case is
has to do with that.
With how far the nose is from the mean of the population.
So this analysis, I mean, most of what you said so far, it applies to the models with strictly fixed population sizes, right?
That's true, yes.
So what happens for experiments with, say, serial dilutions or whatnot? I mean, because that always kind of bothered me that, I mean, in real biology, you never see fixed population sizes to a greater or less extent. They are not fixed. So how would that all change when you relax, for example, an exponentially growing population, or in whatnot, I mean, and serially diluted, which is the same as exponentially growing.
Yeah. first of all, I don't think it's exactly the same as exponentially growing.
Not exactly. I agree, but there are some quite.
I think I mean, there certainly has been some work done on trying to understand how simple quantities, like, for example, fixation probabilities of mutations, depend on specifically experimental regimes in which you propagate your populations. But at least, I mean, maybe some people know this better than I do. I don't think that, so if this kind of work, sort of trying to understand these quantities such as the rate of adaptation, I think this work is usually done in this fixed population size regime, and I don't think people know how to deal with these complications. It's just, and I think the reasoning behind this is that, and I actually don't know whether it's true or not, but I think the general reasoning is that, well, so there's this, when you have this bottleneck regime, there is some kind of effective population size, which maybe you can calculate explicitly sometimes. And you can kind of substitute your fluctuating population with this population of a constant size with an effective population size. I don't know.
No, that's not true. Well,
so I think it is not exactly true, but is that, Boris, do you have any thoughts on that?
There's a reason.
Well, in this clonal interference regime, you would expect, like, as long as the fluctuations in population size are bounded, that they're actually less important than in a drift-dominated regime. Because essentially they govern how important genetic drift is, but genetic drift is not very important in this regime anyway.
And there's a recent research letter by Erwin Frey and collaborators. Some people may know it better than I, but there he does find things where the growing population makes a huge difference.
Yeah. No. So yeah. So there's. Yeah. So in George Plotkin's lab, Todd Parsons, for example, is working on this this model of population genetics, where he relaxes this assumption of population size, and he finds that there are lots of interesting new phenomena that come out of it, just because you have not fixed but sort of fluctuating population size. So, for example, you have, you know, you can no longer describe your mutations by this single number, which is the selection coefficient. So it really matters whether you grow fast in the sort of whether you have an advantage at the population in the exponential phase, or do you have sort of a higher carrying capacity. So it does matter.
Yeah, and bottleneck size in our simulations, which I probably will find, so I will be extremely brief. The bottleneck size plays crucial role in.
Yes. Sure. Certainly.
In dilution, the bottleneck size.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I think this comes back to this question of how do you understand demography? So this is a kind of a demographic parameter, your experimental regime. And I think right now we're still at the place where we're trying to understand these simple things in this fixed population model. And more complicated things are just not very tractable at this point, I think.
I guess one remark, that, you know, the two models are, you know, not really orthogonal by any means, right?
Yeah.
So all that's really required is to redo the Desai-Fisher calculation with distribution of S effects, right? And
that's
actually a rather straightforward generalization.
It is? Okay. So it was not obvious to me that it was very straightforward, but I mean, they're certainly not orthogonal. I agree. Yeah. Okay, so right. Okay, so another, so the complication that I want to talk about today is population structure. So that's sort of that introduces a number of parameters and a number of phenomena that we can think about. So population structure is this. So if your population is not well mixed, and it's not sort of a single population, but instead is subdivided into deems or islands or subpopulations, call them how you like. So the idea is that within each of the subpopulation, there is relatively good mixing going on. So all the individuals that or the all mutations that appear in each of the subpopulations, that they compete with each other. But between between subpopulations, there is not much mixing. So mutations that appear in one of the genes, they're not very likely to meet or compete against mutations that appear in other genes. Well, so they're not completely isolated, but the chance, the migration rate is assumed to be relatively small in such models. So why do we think about why do I want to bother with this complication? So I think there are two reasons. So populations in nature are not well mixed, almost never, I suppose. So we actually have to deal with this complication somehow. But another reason I think is historical, and it has to do with Sewell Wright. So Sewell Wright was a big proponent of studying adaptation in subdivided population. And the reason is you can see this in many of his papers, and this is just probably one of his most cited papers, which is the 1932 paper, where he introduces the notion of a fitness landscape. So he thought, so Wright thought that if you consider a large number of loci, and of course many organisms, or all organisms have a very large number of loci, then the number of possible genomes is extremely huge. So you can imagine that, you know, 10 to the 1,000 is probably an underestimate of all possible genomes that can exist. And so Wright was certain that in this huge space of genomes, there will be many combinations, many sort of specific combinations of alleles that confer larger fitnesses to the organism than any of the neighboring genotypes. So he thought of the fitness landscape as being very rugged. So here he shows, for example, that there are many peaks like this, which are surrounded by valleys. So valleys of lower fitness. And so he thought that the problem of evolution is to understand the mechanism by which populations that are stuck in one of the peaks can cross the valley and find better or higher peaks. And so he thought that this is the most important problem of evolution, and he was convinced that this is impossible in large well-mixed populations. And that's, well, I think it's debatable whether he was right, but he thought that if a population is stuck on one of the peaks, and if it's not well mixed, then it basically cannot escape. The selection cannot act again. Selection tries to keep the population at the peak. And so the only mechanism that he knew about is drift. The other mechanism that can help population escape peak is drift. So he thought that you need to have small populations to actually go from one peak to the other. So you have to drift along these fitness valleys to find other peaks. And so
did he introduce the notion of a preferred path? Presumably, you actually want to go through a saddle,
right,
to get from one to the other.
Yes,
not a valley.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Did you think about that?
He thought exactly. He thought about
optimal paths.
So I don't know if he thought about optimal paths, but he certainly thought about saddles, and he specifically mentioned saddle points in his work.
Yes. Do you mean as opposed to going way down into a valley?
Yes.
Yeah. But I mean, of course, it's very interesting to see what people have thought about evolution in 1932. So I mean, today I think we're neither certain that fitness landscapes are as epistatic or as rugged as Wright envisioned. Nor do we believe that populations get stuck on these fitness peaks, I think. So I think today we're sort of thinking more about populations sitting maybe somewhere in the middle between different peaks, and they have different sort of possibilities. Well, they have different pathways to reach different peaks. So this, so I'm not sure if this legacy that Wright left us is actually important, but I think it is still interesting to see whether population subdivision actually, what the effect of population subdivision is on adaptation. So Wright, just to say a couple of more words about history. So Wright has come up with this shifting balance theory, which was quite an elaborate argument how populations can cross these valleys. So he had these three phases, and I don't want to go into the details, but basically he came up with this argument why and how small subdivided populations can cross these settled points and find better peaks. So we decided to explore this question of how subdivided populations adapt in an experiment, a very simple experiment. We took this the so-called island model, which is sort of the absolutely simplest population subdivision that you can imagine. So you have several deems, and you have perfect, you have mixing between all of them. So there is no spatial or geographic proximity between deems. And there are three parameters in this model. So you have the deem size, the number of deems, and the migration rate between deems. So, and it's quite easy to implement experimentally, this system. So that's what we have done. So the experimental setup is, so we have done this experiment using yeast and in batch culture. So we propagated our populations in these 384-well plates. So each plate has 384, potentially 384 populations or subpopulations. So for example, here I show these five or six wells. So each of these five wells is a little subpopulation, and this is a blank well to control for contamination. And so we can, what we can do is we can transfer every day, we can transfer a sample from this culture into a fresh 384 well plate. And so that would be sort of transferring a subpopulation, but then we can also mix the samples from all these populations and transfer this mixture into each of these wells, and that would simulate mixing or migration.
How do you mix them randomly? You pick up.
No, we just mix all of them. We just mix all of them because in this island model you have perfect. You don't have any structure, right? You take samples from all the subpopulations, you mix, and then you redistribute this.
This is non. I'm trying to remember. You told me this before once. It's non-sticky yeast that you use.
Well, so it was non-sticky in the beginning of the experiment. Yes.
So this is purely asexual.
This is purely asexual. Yes.
So when Wright was thinking about this, was he thinking about recombination?
So Wright was thinking about recombination very much, and I think that was one of his main points that mass selection has to be extremely strong to overcome recombination. So I think it was important in the development of his theory that is recombining.
But and here too, presumably you can also have introduced mating.
We could.
Once we figure out what's happening in the asexual thing, presumably.
Yeah, we certainly could, yeah. Okay, so this is the experiment, and we have run it for 550 generations just to see how adaptation is influenced by mixing. So the results are maybe not very striking. So I think what we see is what we, I suppose, would expect, at least sort of qualitatively. So we expect that, so here I show on the x-axis, I show different degrees of mixing. So no mixing is when you don't mix your little subpopulations at all. Full mixing is when you take your five or whatever 20 deems and mix them completely. So this is a well-mixed population of the same size. and in the in three points in between show different degrees of mixing. And the degree of mixing is can be measured in the number of immigrants per generation. And so, and B is the bottleneck size, so the number of individuals that get transferred every day.
This is a simulation?
No, this is data. This is real data.
So how do you get immigrants to be exactly 20 per generation?
Well, it's not exactly 20. It's sort of a rough, it's roughly 20. So we transfer every we mix every other day, and that's roughly the number of individuals that get transferred from other wells into each
and this thousand is of course also
it's
very
also very rough
now.
yes definitely.
Because you know that from dilution and from spectroscopic or OD whatever
we
how you estimate this number.
We can do the Coulter counting and we just roughly know the density and so on. Yeah.
Which one of those squares is 20
gigs? Yes, it's not possible. Okay, I'm sorry. Well, I suppose you can guess, right? I mean, I'm sorry, the colors, the gray didn't get transmitted very well. Okay, so the 20 genes is the top one, is this one. So the large population, of course, if you look at the well mix, at the well mix population, the population with a larger size got higher fitnesses, so that's the 20 deems, and this is the 5 deems.
So the full mixing condition, do you think that's any different from just having a population size that's 5 times or 20 times as large?
No, I think it's exact. Well, not exactly, but I think it's very very, very close approximation, right? of the yes.
So the population going to grow 10 saturation.
So the saturation phase is not very long. There is a saturation phase, so we don't want to dilute them out. But it's not very.
And how do you define / measure fitness? So what
fitness? So fitness is measured in competition with the using flow cytometry with the with the ancestor strain with the fluorescent marker.
Under which condition do you allow in the growth condition or with saturation?
Under exactly the same condition as the propagation happens. So we propagate them for 3 days, mm-hmm. And measure how the ratio of the wild type to the evolved strain changes.
Okay. And what is the neutral marker?
It's the M cherry.
Yeah.
Yes. So one thing, I guess what I want to mention is that, so it is maybe not surprising. So we see that better mixing leads to faster adaptation. So that is kind of consistent with Fisher's world. So you have mass selection, and of course, bigger the population, the faster it climbs the fitness peak. But so maybe Wright was. I think it's possible that one of the two things is possible. Well, either our fitness landscape is not rugged. So maybe it's possible that our fitness landscape just consists of a single peak, and all the populations just race to that single peak. And of course, the larger the population, the faster it races to the peak, because it gets more beneficial mutations. But it's also possible that we don't really understand how exactly epistasis and demography interact. So it is still, I think, possible that there is a lot of epistasis in this landscape. We just don't see it because we don't know what to expect under no epistasis. So,
but you know how much epistasis you expect and how much you're going to find will very much depend on how far you go. You know, if you're just taking a couple of steps uphill, then sort of a linear approximation without epistasis is fine. But if you want to go a long way, then you need to worry about these things. So.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean that's obviously true, but if I told you today, well, what would you predict if there was no epistasis whatsoever? What would you predict? Where would you put these intermediately mixed populations? I think even that is not completely trivial. So we don't know where to put the expectation here.
And what's the number of immigrants per generation in the full mixing case?
So in the full mixing case, it's Well, it's proportionate to the number of deems, because the more deems you have, the smaller the fraction of your own individuals is.
Okay. But it'd be close to 1,000. I just want to make sure.
It's close to
divided by the number of deems.
Right. Yeah, 1,000.
It's 1,000 minus. It's 1,000 divided. For example, in this five regime, it would be 1,000 divided by five. 1,000 times 4/5.
4/5. Yeah, that's
yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
Right. And the non-monotonic variability with the degree of mixing for 20, is that a real thing?
I think, these populations appear a little bit abnormal. And I think it's just a fluctuation. So the error bars here are, they're pretty big. So I think it is not real.
Are those error bars on the fitness estimate, or did you run replicates?
No, we had many replicates. Yeah. Yes, we had many, we had many replicate populations. Well, to be exact, not many, but we had, so in the 20 deem case, we had 16 different populations, and in the 5 deem case, we had 64 different populations. And on each of them, we ran 3 measurements of fitness. So this is the error on the sort of collapsed estimates of fitness.
But you see the non-monotonicity across biological replicates.
Yeah, we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And was the clumpiness obvious on this time scale? Or?
Well, so it was, it was visible. And clumpiness, so, yes, so one of the things that we saw when we started measuring fitness here is that these many populations, especially large populations, evolved this phenotype, which is clumping, so cells stick together. And that makes the measurement of the fitness more noisy than we would like. But it was still okay.
Well, if you're mixing a clumpy container and a container with non-clumpy,
right,
things,
right,
wouldn't that mess up the mixing somehow? Or
well, but in this fitness measurement, the absolute numbers of individuals that you mix together doesn't matter. What matters is how fast the fraction changes, right? So we measure only the relative ratio. So if you, it doesn't really matter. What matters is how the fraction of the clumping type decreases or increases over time.
If the clumping has produced nutrient shielding, it might have an effect on fitness, for example.
Yes. Yeah, given that this phenotype has evolved many times in our populations, I would imagine that it is beneficial.
It's beneficial,
probably.
And is there an argument why it would be beneficial? Shared resources or something like that?
I don't know. There are certain in these 384 well plates, there are certainly oxygen deprivation going on by the end of the cycle.
I think Andrew Murray has an argument that says that the good things that a cell produces, if it's shared with nearby siblings,
right,
that actually might be an advantage. Maybe that's what's
maybe arriving
at.
Yeah.
How did you do the passages? With Spyfex or with some kind of replicator?
We used the robot, the liquid handling robot.
Works with, so I'm wondering if the sticky things would be more prone to be sampled.
So I don't know how that would happen. I suppose it's possible, but I don't know how.
Yeah, if it's with the 5F, even if the robot, then I don't see it either. But, there are some things where you use some replicator that sticks to them.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I can see that the sticky ones would stick more.
Sure. No, we have done this with a pipette.
Strokes drag on a large clump. I don't know how your robot works, but if it's sucking things in,
yes,
the Stokes drag will be different for a large clump.
Well, so these clumps are not as, I don't think these clumps are large enough that you would see that. I mean, these are maybe like 20 cells sticking together. It's not that big.
Varies with the radius.
Okay. So I actually wanted to ask a somewhat different question. So I'm trying to understand the design and what you were hoping to see you talk about epistasis, but it seems to me that what this addresses most is population size dependence, and you're basically studying clonal competition, right? And the question is, by partitioning population in smaller bits, you're limiting clonal competition, and one can sort of try to figure out which way you actually expect that to affect the adaptation velocity. But to the extent that you're probably only seeing very few mutations here, just as Richard already asked, it's not entirely clear to me why you even expect to see a very rugged landscape. And then presumably you could sort of assess directly, so, okay, if you really sort of start seeing different adaptive peaks, so the interesting thing to look for is like outcrossing depression, right? Then you can make these strains and see what that does to their fitness.
Right.
And I think if we were to bet a small, bottle of champagne here or whatever, we would bet against epistasis under the circumstances.
So I think, you're certainly right that if you have fewer mutations, you're less likely to see epistasis. That's definitely true. But I think you can think about this in sort of from several perspectives, and the one perspective is rugged landscapes, right? So rugged landscapes. So if you imagine a completely rugged landscape, where let's say each genotype, the fitness of each genotype is drawn independently from some distribution. Then there are theoretical results which say that a fitness peak is located two or three steps away from any random genotype, right? So if there was a very strong, if the fitness landscape was extremely rugged, then you would see this kind of thing even in this short-term experiment.
No, but how? Because you start not from a random point in sequence space or whatever.
Yes, but you can go in different directions, right?
Fitness landscape. You start from already non-random adapted population, whatever, whether it's big or not big is a matter of debate, but it's already, so you basically and moving not in random directions and sampling not randomly this landscape, whatever it is.
Maybe if you want to get yourself into a more rugged territory, you can take two very distant strains, cross them in many ways, and then start your different islands with some basically randomly reassembled mosaic genotypes. And so under these conditions, you actually expect to find this outcrossing depression, and your offspring should be less fit than both parents, maybe. And then they would sort of try to recover their fitness and could do that in very different ways, in different dishes.
Well, if you start from different genotypes, if you start from many different genotypes, which are, I suppose, they're in some sense random. I see your point. I think it's a valid point.
Right, but I think still, even if they are different genotypes of yeast, they're still not
they're not completely random,
by any means. I mean, it's not the crocodile and the rabbit.
I think then we're getting into this question of what is random. I mean, how a random genotype is not viable.
Because you have to define your null model. What null model you are addressing?
Well, I think one of I suppose one of my sort of one of the questions that I frequently think about is what is a null model? What is a valid null model? And so maybe a rugged landscape, a completely rugged landscape, may be a valid null model, possibly. Or a non-epistatic landscape could be a null model. But then again, what do we mean exactly by no epistasis? That's another question, I think. So there could be additive no epistasis, multiplicative no epistasis. So I think we have to think carefully about our null models. And So Boris, I agree with you that this experiment doesn't address the question of epistasis directly. I think I completely agree with that. But here we really look at how population subdivision influences adaptation on this particular landscape.
Can I just get the general idea? You were hoping that because of this, the spatial segregation, a mutation, it will be easier for a given mutation to fix, and then when they're mixed, you can start from that starting point and acquire another mutation which might be epistatic.
Right.
And so this is why you were hoping that the islands would be helpful.
Yes, exactly. So in a subdivided population, you can maintain more diversity, and because of that, you can possibly find other peaks, different peaks, possibly better peaks.
So if this was your goal, then you succeeded, right? You said the efficacy decrease when you peaks compared to where you don't peaks.
No, but it didn't succeed because you know, well, from my perspective, I guess. Let me put it like this. From Wright's perspective, that would be a failure because he would say that he would predict that poorly mixed populations in the middle should do better than these guys, because you know he would probably predict that these guys are already stuck at the peak and they have so few beneficial mutations that they cannot basically move. And these guys are drifting a little bit. And so they can reach other peaks.
I guess a good control experiment, which exactly in the spirit of what was discussed here, is to do exactly the same, but without DIMs, etc., but with five times or whatever larger population
right.
size.
Right.
So if you simply kind of compare smaller population size and large population size without all this kind of 384 wells.
Well, I have this data in the next slide.
I have this data. Yes. Okay, that will
yes.
Come.
Okay. So coming back to well-mixed populations, so let's look at the distribution. That was a byproduct of the same experiment. So we looked at these population sizes we looked at well-mixed populations with different population sizes. So this no, full 5, full 10, and full 20 are populations that are well-mixed, but that their population size differs by a factor of 20. So the small ones maybe they have a bottleneck size of 10 to the 3, and the large ones have a bottleneck size of 200,000. So what I'm showing here is the distribution of mean fitnesses of the populations. So if you look at replicate populations, and you look at their mean fitnesses, so this is the distribution of the ensemble distribution that you get. And
how many replicates again?
Right. So here in this panel we have 640 independent small populations. So the larger the population gets, the smaller number of replicates we have. And it's not visible. So for example, here we have 64, and on these two we have 32. It's not visible on these histograms because in these histograms I just pulled all the fitness measurements together. So this is kind of raw data. Basically, if I computed the fitnesses with error bars, it would be only 32 points here, and 32 points here, and 64 points here.
With what frequency did things show up in your control wells? How much splashing?
It's a non-zero frequency, but I can't tell you exactly the number out of the top of my head, but it was not very large. I would say it was probably in the order of maybe five times, five instances over the course of the experiment.
Five instances out of 1,000?
Out of about 4,000 wells.
Okay,
yeah.
So the striking feature seems to be the appearance of a long tail, right?
Exactly, yes, yes. So, right. So one thing that I want to, sort of draw your attention to is that comparing these distributions, by comparing these distributions, we can see that all populations except for the small one are in the multiple mutation regime. And the reason why, so how can we see this? So we can see this by looking at the maximum at this sort of tail of this distribution here. So the best of the small populations that that we see has fitness advantage of roughly 2%, so here. And all the other ones have fitnesses of, you know, this guy has 3% mean, and these ones are even larger. So if all these mutations, if these populations, the full five populations, have fixed on average only one mutation, then you would expect that in the small populations the same mutation would appear at least sometimes. So you would expect that the best of the small populations would be at least as large as the mean of the next larger population. So it's because we don't see this, because these populations are much less fit than these ones, the larger populations must have fixed at least two mutations.
So, but
these,
you mean the mean population fitness, so it's not just fixed mutations, it's whatever.
Yeah, they're sure. Yes.
Well, I don't know what I would expect.
Well, I mean, I think that you're right. This introduces some complications, but I think the basic argument can be still made. But if it was only one mutation, then it would appear, you know, it has exactly the same chance of appearing over all our populations here as it is here.
But the speed of increase in frequency.
Yeah, but it would substitute quicker here, right? If it appeared in the small populations, it would fix quicker here. So you would, you know, if it was one mutation of 5%, let's say, it would, you know, you would see it here.
Okay. So when you measure fitness, do you see that the population is diverse, meaning that, you know, as you sort of continue on measuring fitness, you sort of the population gets fitter?
You mean over time?
Yeah.
So, yes, we do. We didn't do sort of a systematic measurement of all populations, but in several pilots we did these intermediate time points, and yes, they do.
So it is accelerating, kind of.
So I wouldn't say it's accelerating, but it's certainly growing. The fitness is growing continuously in the larger populations, not in these ones. So these ones are, as you see, they're not, you know, they're progressing very slowly. Okay, so right. So there are multiple mutations. That's.
What do you mean that? I would expect the mutation rate to be something like 10 to the minus 8.
The total mutation rate.
Total mutation rate.
Probably even larger. Smaller.
What is genome size, please?
It's roughly 10 to the 7.
So
you expect roughly.
Maybe about a 1% chance then for a particular mutation to show up?
So it's roughly 1%, and I mean, presumably most of these are not beneficial. So you presumably have much smaller chance of getting a beneficial mutation, yeah.
Can you say something then? If there's a very exponential distribution of beneficial mutations, then this could also be that although you have member identities, I can see that, but are you quite sure that the small population would actually have instances of strong effect mutations?
We have these populations which have roughly 2% advantage. Would that satisfy you? Would that be a strong effect mutation? I suppose.
I'm wondering, maybe the skewness of the others would have to do with the others getting the chance of having strong effect mutations, which the small population doesn't get just because they're there.
So that's exactly what I'm trying to argue against, because if you imagine this, I mean, they all start with the same genotype, right? If there was just one mutation that had, you know, let's say 10% advantage, then of course, larger populations have a larger chance of discovering it. So it sort of every large population has a larger chance of discovering it. But because we're looking at many more, so this distribution is actually really good. This is you know, very, very good picture of what happens in reality. So we really know what mutations happened in each of the small populations, sorry, which benefits each of the small populations got, right? So if there was this one really good effect mutation, then you would see it at least in one of these small populations, presumably, right? Because, so...
Saying the combined chance of these many small is equivalent.
So the combined, so a combined chance is different. So that's exactly what I'm trying to say. So, so I think that what happens is that in large populations you have these multiple mutations that are stacked up, one on top of the other. So this is not just one large effect mutation that got fixed here. This is many possibly smaller effect mutations here.
In a single genome, right? So that's what you're talking about. And they are more easily discovered in large population than in multiple small populations.
Yes. So you can think about this. So Lily, you can think about this in a very simple way. So we have one 3D four-well plate, which has 16 populations of size 20, and another plate which has 320 populations of size 10. Right. So the number of mutations that happen in these two plates is exactly the same. So you would see, you know, if it was one mutation, you would see it appear here and here.
So could it be that there are mutations that are only beneficial in big populations, like stickiness or whatever?
I suppose it can. I mean, that's the thing that, yes.
Does stickiness correlate with your tail, for example?
Stickiness correlates with the tail, yes. So stickiness is beneficial.
So you do deems here, right?
So there are no deems here. This is all well mixed, and it happens that it there is certainly a correlation between fitness and stickiness. So stickiness is beneficial. I don't know if it correlates with
the wall, but in the big population, the wall is all occupied. They have to go to the wall.
But the conditions are exactly the same, right? I mean, there is no sort of no experiment.
But you're not scaling up the wall.
Sorry?
You're not scaling up the container as you make the populations bigger.
Well, that's exactly what you would want to do, right? So to have a perfect control, that's exactly what you want to do. So there's no sort of methodological difference here.
I mean, you'd think there'd be an advantage to be going into the corners of your vial because the goods that you would secrete would be beneficial would bounce back on you.
Yes, but that would be the same in smaller and large populations, right?
Not necessarily, because depending on the size of the population, the availability of corners will change.
No, because they live in exactly the same wells, right?
The cell density is the same in these different population sizes, because it's just a question of whether you're mixing these, you know, 5, 10, 20 different subpopulations together. So that's how he's changing population size.
The wall stickiness, then the cell density will vary within the vial.
Yes. But it will be, I mean, my point, I guess, is that we don't have any, I think we have a really good control for population size. So the only thing that can happen, I mean, basically all the things that can happen in the large population can happen also in the small populations, I think.
So that's an easy way, I think, to solve the problem. So when you measure fitness, you have to use one of the bottlenecks.
Yes, so you just use the first one and the last one for all, and you see if these are different. So mutations that could only be beneficial in the large population set would have higher fitness, if you measure them with big bottleneck. Okay, sure, yeah, that's very easy control. Yeah, and actually, how do you do this? Which during the competition, which population? During the competition, we always use the small bottleneck. Yeah.
If you look ahead and sequencing costs go down, is there hope for actually sequencing something out of the tail of these distributions and finding out?
Well, in principle, we can sequence. But do you have any expectation? What we would?
Well, I just have an expectation. It would be extremely interesting to know how they have changed in that tail. You could see whether it was multiple mutations, whether the mutations had to do with stickiness or not. So,
right.
I mean, at least hopefully.
Right. Yes. I mean, it certainly. I think the probably the most productive way, sort of, to use sequencing is to count the number of mutations. So if we knew exactly how many mutations on average have these populations substituted, I think that would be good.
I think another, kind of along the same line as David said, just another interesting question is reproducibility of this mutation. So you take them from different peaks and ask whether mutations appear. Most likely they will get irreproducible, most likely they will appear in different places, but how many of them and what's the distribution, et cetera,
whether there's convergent.
Right. Whether there are some kind of decisive mutations which are more or less in every cell, which is highly unlikely to happen, or there will be some sort of a set of various mutations in various scenarios.
Eugene, I think I'm not very fond of this idea because, well, we ran this experiment in a very particular way. We had this 3D4-old plates, we did this transfers, and, well, suppose you saw some convergence. I mean, what does it really tell us about anything except our experiment? I'm not sure that, you know, we really want to know what happened exactly in our experiment. This is a very specific experiment, I think, and it doesn't tell us much about
it. But it tells us as much as the whole question that you're asking with this.
I see. You're saying whether they go to the same peak or not.
That's right.
Okay, fine. That's exactly
the point. Because you're asking exactly this question, and the only way to answer it in some sense is to answer it as microscopically as possible.
Sure. Okay. That is a fair point. I agree. Okay, so
what do you think distribution looks like in the case of the teams?
I could show you if you want.
Is it interesting? Does it look like the low?
It looks sort of
moves too high.
I would say it looks a little bit. It looks like it is intermediate between you know this peak distribution and this broad distribution. It's sort of intermediate. They have more variation. They have more variation than no mixing at all, but less than the large one.
Do they have the tail?
Not certainly not as large as this one. I can show you later if you want. Yeah.
Earlier you talked about some theoretical results about how fitness evolves in time depending on the scaling, whether it is proportional to population size.
Yeah.
With this sort of data, can you compare?
Yeah, we can. So here's the comparison actually. If you plot the mean fitness of a population against the population size, so you get this really nice logarithmic dependence. So which also suggests that these populations are in the multiple mutation regime. And so in fact, I just realized this yesterday. So you can actually use these two figures to make some inferences about the selection coefficient and mutation rates of beneficial mutations. So we have this theoretical prediction for the slope of this line, which is given by this combination of parameters. So S is the selection coefficient of sort of an average mutation, mu is the rate of beneficial mutations, and T is the number of generations. And so we can have this prediction for the slope. And from this picture, we can count, if we assume that populations that have increased in fitness got at least one beneficial mutation, and the populations that did not increase in fitness did not get any beneficial mutations. So this is an assumption. So if we make this assumption, we can we can write down this fraction of populations that got at least one beneficial mutations as something like that. This is an approximation from the Poisson distribution. So we have these two equations that have that have all the parameters that we need, and we can in principle try to solve them and get the S's and mu's from this experiment. So I've done this very roughly.
But this is provided that you have only one S, right?
Yeah. It's extremely crude, and it's
okay.
Yeah, but you know, even if you do this very crude calculation, you get pretty reasonable numbers. So you have, you know, maybe an underestimate of the mutation rate and slightly overestimated the selection coefficient. But I think it is roughly at least on the order of magnitude of what people have found.
This is beneficial mutations.
These are for beneficial mutations. Yeah.
So going back to your fitness measurements, if you're looking for epistasis, then the natural way is
actually competing two subpopulations against each other, which have different fitnesses, and then see if the fitness that you measure with respect to the wild type is additive or not.
Is that really?
It's one easy way, right?
That is certainly a way to measure something. I'm not sure it's exactly epistasis because, I mean, I would imagine that
it can be a result of epistasis.
It can result from epistasis, but it doesn't necessarily, it won't necessarily detect all the epistasis that there is.
That's true.
That will measure interactions between genotypes,
right.
Not interactions
between genes.
Yeah. And epistasis is defined just here between genes. Within one gene.
If they're combined, then it will be epistasis.
So your P1 here is 67%, that's pretty high.
Yeah.
So in principle, the probability of getting two beneficial mutations would be the square.
Yeah. So you shouldn't do the, this approximation is, but it's not perfect, yeah. But I just didn't bother with exponentials because All these calculations are so crude that.
Yeah, because in a way, the problem with this estimate is that you actually have a distribution of S. And you also need a model for the error you make on the fitness, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not trying to convince you that these formulas have to be, are good or these numbers are accurate. I'm just saying that in principle, this is a way to estimate these parameters. So if I thought a little bit more about this, I think we could come up with a better estimate of P1, just based on the distribution of fitnesses. I think we could.
It would also be very helpful to get another time point.
Maybe you should tell me why it is helpful.
It would be very interesting to see. You really want to understand something about the regime that you are in. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we're sort of happily trying to fit the Seyfert-Fisher velocity there, which is sort of assuming that you sort of already established the distribution, which is moving, but you're really starting from a clonal population, kind of cold start. And the number of mutations, maybe one, maybe two, maybe
sure.
Five. So, I think it would be quite helpful to see if, for example, if you're really in this regime, you should see more or less the translation of that distribution, which I bet you will not see.
No, certainly.
So I think that will be quite informative.
Yeah, sure.
I guess along the lines, is it just a matter of pulling some stuff out of the freezer and actually measuring the fitnesses at some earlier time, or do you have to run it further in time?
No, we can just pull them out of the freezer and do this assay. That's not very difficult. Yeah, you're saying that if we... I mean, there's a bunch of things we could do. So this is measuring another time point is certainly one of them. But what would you expect? Would you want to look at this kind of line at an earlier time point? So you would expect not to see a logarithmic dependence at an earlier time point, for example, or what? Or would you like to look at, for example?
I don't have any expectation. It depends on whether you're anywhere close to this asymptotic regime.
Right.
So if you're in an asymptotic regime, so what I'd really like to see is what's happening to the shape of that distribution at two different
times. You don't really want to look at the different time points. I think you want to look at the, within the population, what's the distribution of fitnesses within the population, right? Probably. That would be the most direct proof.
Within the population?
Yes, if you just
took clones
from the population. And if you saw that,
I think that also this linear prediction of the t, the slope out of which p is t, I think is also an interesting statement that you're using it in all your derivations, right, or your calculation here. So it'd be neat to know how close it is to being true.
Yeah. Yeah, we certainly could do another time point. Okay, so last slide. In the last slide, I just want to show you some expectations for you know, what would we expect to see in these well-mixed populations if there was no epistasis? So, and the quantity that, so basically the reasoning is this. So if we looked at these distributions and we saw that these distributions are, first of all, the larger the populations, the broader the distribution, and it's also skewed. So we thought that maybe this breadth of the distribution is tells us something about the epistasis that goes on in this fitness landscape. So I plotted here the mean again of the population and the interquartile range of the distribution of fitnesses against the population size. So you see, so here we see that the population, that the distributions do indeed get broader. So now what we can do, of course, is run simulations with on the simplest possible fitness landscape, where you have a certain number of sites, certain mutation rate, take the mutation rate to be, and the selection coefficients of mutations at those sites to be, you know, roughly realistic, and take population sizes that are roughly similar. And what do we see? So we see something like this. So we see that, first of all, fitness increases roughly linearly in the logarithm of population size. Here we see some slight nonlinearity here, which has to do with deleterious mutations. But the variance or the breadth of the distributions is actually non-monotonic. So there is some intermediate population size here, where basically the evolution becomes least predictable, right? And this population size is roughly a population size at which a population gets one large effect beneficial mutation. So there is this large error, large Poisson error here in these populations. And the larger populations get almost deterministically these large effect mutations. And that's why the variance goes down between populations. So it would be interesting to know where, at which population size in our experiment, we would expect to see this population, at which population size do we get one beneficial mutation per generation? And so I suspect it's somewhere here. So I think it's between the smallest and the second smallest population. So these populations, I think, already get multiple beneficial mutations. And if this is true, so if we can indeed reject the no epistasis case, then I think it is interesting to try to understand what kind of epistasis can cause this spread of the distributions or unpredictability in the evolution of large populations. So that's what we're going to try to do. And that's all I wanted to say today. So I want to thank, first of all, of course, Michael and Josh Plotkin for my advisors, and Dan Rice and also all the other members of the Desai Lab for helping me with the experiment, and Fei Li, who actually carried out a large part of the experiment. So thanks.
So since you get a higher variability than you would expect, does that also means that you have you get extremely good fitness and better fitness than you would expect from the non-epistasis?
I think
epistasis in that case is only enhances the effect of mutations.
Well, no, I don't think it only enhances the effect of mutations. I think epistasis makes, what is epistasis? Epistasis is the dependence of the effect of a mutation on the background.
But you can put a sign on this effect.
Yes.
Beneficial or detrimental?
I think some mutations make other mutations more beneficial, and some mutations make other mutations less beneficial. So you exactly would expect this increase in the breadth of the distribution, because if you know a particular population got a particular beneficial mutation, right? This beneficial mutation has some particular effect on further mutation. It can be, you know, it can increase them, it can decrease them, it can change them in some way. So because you have this difference in which mutations got fixed in different populations, you have this less predictability in the increase in frequency. So some mutations do better, some don't.
Maybe it was asked, but do you have any idea what is the distribution of fitnesses for the different genotypes in one population, one well-mixed population?
Right. So we don't at this point, but we could in principle measure that, and I think that's one of the things that we are considering doing.
Okay, thanks.